Welcome, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. I am Paul Niefer, your host, and today we're going to have a conversation with Bruce Vandesteeg from Greeley, Colorado. Bruce, how are things going?
Hey, it's going really well. It's a gorgeous day. Nice day to live in Colorado.
Yeah, although I think in about 2 days, it's going to be, 30 degrees colder and snow. So, but I think we all agree we need the snow.
Yep. Winter's coming. It happens. But, man, today is beautiful.
Oh, I know. I was just, before we started taping this, I went outside and threw the Frisbee or the disc for my we have about a 5-year-old lab that thinks she's a greyhound, and she wants to, go 30 miles an hour chasing a little Frisbee. So, and then there's 3 other labs that try to chase her, and they're the more the English style, and they can't catch up. So, but enough about dogs and Colorado weather. We always like to start off with background. So where were you born? Where did you go to college, and how you got started in your career?
So, born and raised in Chino, California, back when it was a big dairy mecca, I guess you could call it.
Yep.
Decided I wanted to be a veterinarian at a young age and work with cows. So I went through high school and went to UC Davis. I did 8 years at UC Davis, undergraduate, and I got my doctorate in veterinary medicine from Davis and graduated in 1992.
Okay.
Entered practice that year.
And was that in California, or where did you enter practice?
It is. So I started in California in the north part of the Central Valley in a little town called Oakdale.
Oh, yeah.
I started in mixed practice, mostly dairy, but did some small and some equine, and quickly realized that I just wanted to be on farms. And so about 2.5 years into practice life, I started my own practice and focused exclusively on food animals. So dairy, beef. And I did that for 15 years. Then it was kind of time for transition. I was kind of getting a little bit, I guess, bored, if you will. and thought about becoming a dairyman, and I met a guy and we became partners, and we built a dairy in Colorado. And so people ask me, well, why did you do that? And I go, it was just opportunity, right? It's just always been about opportunity, not like a ladder climber. Just there's an opportunity. It sounds good. And we take it. So I sold my practice and everything I owned in California and moved to outside of Greeley, Colorado. We built a dairy from the ground up, and I ran that for 5 years. And then that partnership's time needed to end. So I sold out. I transitioned to corporate America, which I never thought I was going to go do. And I became a technical services veterinarian. And about 1.5 years into that, they tapped me and said, hey, we want you to become a sales manager. I'm like, well, I've never done that before. Another opportunity popped up. And so I got into management, and I managed the dairy and beef business for that company from Texas to Washington.
That's a little bit of geography there.
It's a little geography. It's quite a large chunk of geography. So, but it was just the dairy and beef side, which helps. But boy, I got to see a lot of beautiful country and meet a lot of neat people. And you're focusing on, the dairy and beef side. So those are all in pockets, right? You kind of handle, the panhandle of Texas was my deal, Southwest Kansas, Northeast Colorado, kind of the corner of Utah, the twin, was it Magic Valley and Treasure Valley of Idaho, kind of deal. So, and then I decided that travel was too much. They wanted, about 4 to 5 days a week of travel, and I still had kids at home, and I thought, I'm going to go back and pick up my consulting business again. And so I did. So I transitioned out, went to consulting, and then I wanted to keep investing. And so I made the random, not necessarily random, but I mostly look at why, but I got in the car wash business. And partly because I needed some place for my kids to work, and I wanted some place for my money to keep growing. So, and I thought, well, there's pumps and vacuum and other things, not unlike a dairy barn. And so we got in the car wash business, and I bought one that needed some extra work and expansion, and that leveraged that into another one that needed to be fixed. So I kind of ended up in that fix and repair car wash deal. I did that for about 5 years, and then I think one day my wife looked at me and goes, "Why are we still doing this?" And I says, "Well, maybe the kids want it." So we asked the kids, and the kids like, "We don't want anything to do with it." And went,
that we sounds sold them. Pretty normal. Yeah.
Yep. We sold them. It was, and I remember the first Christmas after they were sold, and I was sitting in my living room, and I looked, I go, "Something's really weird." And all of a sudden I realized it's the first time in 30 years I hadn't been on call for something. And which is really quite nice. I didn't mind if it snowed, because if it snowed, I didn't have to clear it. I didn't have to go out in it. And so I just kept the consulting piece up, and I joined I was one of the three founding members of a tech startup in the dairy software world, and did that for about 3 years, and decided that I really wasn't into sales, and became a full-time consultant. Like, I think one of the questions you had in your list was like, you know, what are your hobbies? And like, well, it's really a business, but it's kind of a hobby. And I flip homes on the side as well. So that's kind of the career story right there.
So let's go back to the dairy. So that was a dairy in northeastern Colorado. Was that Holstein, Jersey, Guernsey, conventional, organic? Just expand a little bit more on just what type of dairy that was.
So we were all Holstein. We shipped milk to Safeway. And we milked right around 3,500 cows, and it was a conventional farm. So, okay.
And that Safeway, is that the plant down here in Denver?
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Right off of I-70. So,
yep. So it's kind of cool to be able to tell your employees, is like, you know, everybody needs to have a why. You know, why are we doing what we're doing? And we're sitting down with them all one day, and I asked them where they bought their milk, and you know, it was either Safeway or King Supers, and I says, "Well, gentlemen, ladies, you're drinking what you make." And they looked at me, and they didn't get that concept. And so then also they started realizing that, oh, we're making food for our local, you know, community.
Yeah.
And it really, I think it motivated them, gave them more sense of purpose for what we're doing. It became real, you know.
Of course, you know, if it goes through, you know, Safeway, Albertson's going to come under the umbrella of Kroger, which King Supers is part of Kroger. So it'll, you know, whether you go to King Supers or Safeway, it's probably going to be the same milk.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, so I'm just curious on the dairy software business, was that dealing with breeding or management or accounting, or what type of software was that?
So our goal was to create an enterprise resource program, because there was nothing that was all inclusive in the dairy world. So we started by building the backbone first, so that all the apps could plug into something and all the data could be shared. So that's the first piece we did. And then we built some feeding software designed to feed cows. So from feed trucks, you know, and loaders, and it was all using new technology. So everything was on your phone.
Yep. Yep.
Very little hardware. You had to have Wi-Fi. It was very nimble, very easy to use. Since there's a lot of multi-language people, you know, from Portuguese to Spanish to Kai, you know, the Guatemalans, and people picked it up quickly. And then we went into developing the animal side, which was for breeding records and milk records and basically anything to do with the records on a cow. And then we developed training software, so you could track and provide training for employees. And then we were starting to get into, about the time I left, facility maintenance type stuff. So how are your pumps working? You know, are things, you know, little sensors on different things, so you could tell if things were going to fail, how they're doing, from chemicals to the wash system to pumps and gates and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm sort of curious. And again, I'm going a little bit off script here, but I'm a curious guy. In the dairy, you know, as far as milking, you have some of these robots out here, and I saw some of those in New York State a few years back. Is that still a trend, or is it really going back to more conventional, or you're a dairy person, fill me in and fill the listeners in a little bit as to how cows are being milked these days?
So most of the barns are still conventional barns, because they've been built and they've got a lifespan of 20 to 30, 40 years. But the trend is to go to robots, either individual robots or the trend is to make, or to put in a conventional barn, but you're putting robots in that do a lot of the routine work, which is cleaning cows, spraying disinfectant on the cows, teats when they go around, and then someone just hangs the machine. So it's becoming more and more automated as the labor is tight, and finding consistent labor is difficult.
Yep.
And the machines just work all the time, and some of the activities are so monotonous and so repetitive that it lends itself well to the robot. So the robot piece is really growing, but it's still not the majority of the farms.
I remember watching a cow went into the little individual robot to be milked, and something happened where suddenly, the cow's falling down on the ground. She gets up, she kicks the machine, but then she finally got herself milk. So it was mm-hmm. sort of, you're curious to watch how it works, but you're right. I mean, labor these days is difficult, and I don't think it's going to get any easier.
No, we're in that trend of, the largest generations are, retiring. Millennials is a large population, but Gen Z is less, and we don't have a good immigration policy. It's just going to be tight.
Yeah,
it's just is what it is, and the economy's growing in other sectors. So it's just kind of a reality of life that we find ourselves in.
Yeah. Now, what you're doing now is you are consulting. So let's mm-hmm. expand on what type of consulting, how you consult for like farmers in the industry and so on. So let's expand on that.
Okay. So my consulting practice is based around what I would call organizational health. So it's anything to do with how do we have a healthy, profitable business. So I get into quite a bit of leadership stuff. I help people. The common request is I feel like I've hit a ceiling and I don't know how to get past it. Or my phone rings all the time. I'm busy. I want to grow. And I'm just overwhelmed. And how do I handle the chaos? Because I love business, but I just don't know where to go. And so it involves around a lot of process type stuff, organization charts, understanding what roles we have in a business, and then what people should fill those roles. The whole Jim Collins piece of, you got to get the right people in the right seat. So we talk a lot about having the right people. And so it's kind of, it ends up being a bit of a reorganization to kind of get the business back on the track they want to go. So I typically start with the question of what does winning look like, for the owners or for the management team. And that's a holistic question, not just say financially, but it's, where do they want to go with the company? What's their why? How does this fit in with their work and their life? And kind of, so it's a very holistic approach to how do we have, create a really great, vibrant business that is good for them and good for the employees so that the whole thing works very holistically.
And I know looking at your, I'm going to call it CV or resume and so on, that you were involved. One of the consulting engagements you had was with a dairy in California that was losing money. Can you share how you were able to turn that around, or what was some of the key things that worked for that situation?
Yeah. So that dairy had fallen into some lack of good management. The owner had multiple businesses, and so they ended up with a lot of employee turnover. They had quite a bit of death loss going on, cows and calves. They just had processes that weren't working. So in that particular situation, I stepped in and actually ran the dairy. One of the owner's kids wanted to learn how to become a dairyman. So they basically tutored them. And so I kind of started off doing most everything and then slowly just phased myself out over about a 6-month period. And it was, we just recreated all the systems, got our arms around who the staff was, why we had turnover, what was going on with the cows as far as, we had some feeding issues, we had some health issues. And you start just looking at what are the different problems and what you think the underlying root cause is. And we just went after those things. So we went from, turnover is over about 200%. and got it down to about 30% by the time I, you know, that they were ready to take the thing over. Mm-hmm. And then just a lot of processes, you know, who does what, when, schedules, so that things just weren't missed. You know, the money's in the details, and we had to get the basics down, and then we had to start working on the details. And so they learned how to have meetings, how to communicate, how to interview, how to hire well, how to train and onboard people, how to retain people. There's a lot of it was around that people retention, quality people side, mm-hmm. because I could tell every client that there's not a problem with a cow that doesn't have not have a human attached. So we got to fix the human side and the cow problems go away. And that's what happened. They were losing about $500,000 a month, and we turned that into a positive cash flow situation in 6 months.
Now, so I'm going to key in a little bit on the death loss side. Like mm-hmm. you say, that's a people. I mean, granted, the cow is the one suffering, dying, and the calf and so on. But is that because people just don't have ownership, or what was the key reason why you were having large death loss, and how do you turn that around? Just for the listeners.
Mm-hmm. So on this particular place, there was a disconnect between management and labor. And labor didn't feel like they had a role mm-hmm. in how things are done. There's no autonomy. There's no training. And so if you don't, they were just a tool. And when people realize that you really don't care about them, that you're just there to use them, they cease to care, right? They don't have any equity in the deal. And that was a lot of what was going on. They are just putting time in, right? And sometimes you'd find them doing nothing or hiding or whatever, or just doing sloppy work. And so we had to change management's perspective and get the right people leading, right? Leadership, in my opinion, is where everything rises and falls, you know. And with good leadership, the rising tide lifts all ships. And that's really what changed this place, is we changed the leadership so that people would follow the leaders, and they did. And so once they started caring, because they knew that the leaders cared about them as people, then they the dairy really started to turn around.
I'm just curious a little bit. Again, I'm gonna veer off a little bit. You had mm-hmm. mentioned that you currently or were flipping homes. Are you still doing that, and is there a particular type of home you look for? I know this is not quite ag related, but I'm just sort of curious. Yep. Is it primarily in that Greeley area, or do you go outside of that area? I'm just curious on that.
So we do go outside the area. We do. I've been active in Oklahoma, but that area, right, I didn't really want to travel much. So I've been flipping homes in Oklahoma for about a year now. So actively we're typically in the northern Colorado area, Longmont to Fort Collins. And funny you say that, we are going to finish a home today. So I'm done with this podcast. I'm going to go over to a house and wrap it up, and it'll get pictured today and go on the market on Friday.
Okay. So what would be the typical home you're looking at rehabilitating and flipping?
We try to get into what's changed. We want single family homes, typically something that we can do something to. So we typically buy houses that are in disarray, or that people have not taken very much good care of, and then go in and basically take kitchens out, bathrooms out. We may move walls. The house that we're doing now was a 1913 Craftsman home. Mm-hmm. So we completely redid the basement. Like, the basement had the old boiler and pole door in, and we took all those systems out. So we modernized an old home, so you can live in a old looking home, right, with all the old classic wood trim and wood floors, but with modern furnaces and air conditioning and electric and kitchen and you know, bathrooms. And so something that's we buy them, you know, below market because they're in a state of disrepair. And then we try to turn them into homes that people can really enjoy and enjoy living in.
Are you noticing any drop off due to the increase in interest rates? I mean, I think it's being offset with a lack of demand. A lack of supply. There's still demand, but there's no supply. So what are you seeing as far as the interest rate increase?
So the buyer pool has shrunk dramatically. Certain areas, the prices have fallen. Not huge, but enough that if you buy a house and, you know, like we bought this house in August, sell it in November, that the price will fall in that 2 to 3 month period. So you got to kind of work that into your budget. You have to have a seller to have a buyer, because most of the homes are owned by somebody. They're not brand new homes, you know, being built as much as there used to be. So it's just a tighter market, and it's become a buyer's market instead of a seller's market, which, you know, it always kind of bounces around.
Yep.
But the interest rate have really, you know, it's raise our cost of money, right, to fund the rehab part. And it's changed the ability of the buyer to buy. So we used to be in the entry-level home, which is, I really loved being in that space, and I've had to get out of that space because the entry-level buyer is struggling to be able to make a home work. And right, so we're into that more mid-level to high-level home, because those people have enough down payment and can swing a mortgage. So we shifted our price range. So we're actually remodeling more expensive homes than we used to, just so that we can stay where there's a buyer pool.
Yep. Very interesting. I this is the top producer podcast, but it's still interesting to see what people are doing besides just maybe the farming side. So let's go ahead and take a break for a sponsor message, and we'll come back and have a little bit of a discussion on entrepreneurship. So we'll take a quick break. Sounds good.
How many years away is the long run for a farmer? 5 years? 10 years? Top producers like Hans Reinschi, a Blue Diamond farming company in Jessup, Iowa, know Rabo Agri Finance shares his enduring vision for the future.
Whether it's I'm building our grain site, or if it's purchasing the next field, we're able to turn to Rabo as a trusted partner to help us get financing to make those generational decisions.
With unmatched financial capacity, local relationship managers, and a global network of sector experts to offer market guidance, Rabo Agri Finance provides enterprising farmers with a personalized approach to lending and financial services. Growing a better world together, Rabo Agri Finance.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Neefe, your host, and we're going to rejoin our conversation with Bruce Vandesteeg from Greeley, Colorado. So, Bruce, you're certainly, I would call you a serial entrepreneur, and even myself, you know, I've been involved in various businesses besides just being a CPA, and now I guess I have farms in Washington, Idaho, Washington, Iowa, and Missouri. So I view most farmers as being an entrepreneur. I'm just curious, what's your thoughts on farmers sort of being, or what causes a farmer to be an entrepreneur?
So, you know, most of the ones I've worked with, there's a love of business. And as your business grows, you start to look at what are the other opportunities, because you don't want to just sit and, you know, just odd as it sounds, you don't want to just sit and make money, right? Money is important, but it's not all about money. Money, and I think, is just the chip on the game board.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you move it around and what you do with it. And so as they're looking at their business, as it grows, they're like, well, do I vertically integrate or do I horizontally expand? And they're just looking for those pieces that will make their business either more profitable or give them a stronger position. And they've got creative minds, and so their minds are never stop thinking, and they're pondering and go, what's the next thing? Because they're not complacent, We have that conversation between what's complacent and content. I think a lot of them are content, but they're not complacent. And contentment doesn't mean that you're just going to sit and do nothing. It means, hey, I enjoy what I'm doing, but I've got this brain, right? God created me to think and to live, and I want to go and expand. And so they've just got this intuitive or natural desire to see things grow, right? They're farmers. They want to see things grow. And so it's not just plants or cows. It's their business. And then that just naturally lends to being an entrepreneur. And frankly, if you're not really kind of a little entrepreneurial, you might not last.
Yeah.
So
now what I've seen in my career of working with entrepreneurs is sometimes as they expand, you know, there comes to that point where, let's say, sometimes they're not process orientated, you know, not detail orientated. So that can create some issues later on. Is that a lot of times when you step in as a consultant to help them bridge that sort of that gap from being an entrepreneur to being more of a, I guess, a business that can operate maybe without them? You know, a lot of entrepreneurs are great for starting it, but sometimes as far as running it, they run into some issues. I'm just curious how you help in that process.
That's a big spot, because typically you grow things, you kind of grow it on your back, right? And you push forward and you work hard and you grow it and you grow it. And there comes a point in time where you have to shift from, I can handle all this, and it's a very flat organization chart, to also I have to have people helping me. You know, and so, like, I'm pretty sure you mentioned you got farms in a couple different states, that you can't farm on all those states. Like, you have to have somebody doing the work and overseeing the day to day. And so they do get that spot where it's like, also it becomes more than they can handle. And so things tend to start slipping, and they start to notice there's some slippage, or it's not quite what, like, they want it to be, or they're just stressed. They don't have any free time, or there's just, and that's, there's, and kind of when they get to that point, because there needs to be enough pain typically before they'll call a guy like me.
Yeah. Right?
If there's enough pain, they're not going to call. You know, the beauty is once there's enough pain, they call, right? Like, I get to do what I love doing, but it's, you get to really see things transform, right? Their life transforms, the employees transform, and they kind of just, and they, like I say, that glass ceiling goes away, and they've got a whole new space to kind of move into. And it really allows them to go enjoy their business again and kind of get back in that entrepreneurial position, because they figure out what their role is and where they fit, and then what the roles need to be underneath them to keep the whole thing rolling.
So if there was a listener out there that says, hey, I'm in that period of pain and I need help from somebody like Bruce, how would they be able to contact you?
Phone or email, right? So I don't know, do you post that stuff, or do I say
it? Just say it on the air. You know, we typically don't post it, but you can just say it on the air.
Yeah. So the phone number is 970-397-4902. And the email is bvandesteeg@gmail.com.
Okay. Okay. Perfect. Perfect. Well, I always like to end our conversations with three or four key questions I like to ask. Mm-hmm. First is, who is your mentor, maybe in the vet side or the dairy side or the consulting side?
So vet side were several, one of the main ones. And he started being my mentor when I was 16, and we're still friends today. It was Walt Guterbach, has taught me tremendous amount. And it's funny, you think about that when you're young, you're like, oh, I did this on my own. And now I look back, I go, man, I walked on the backs of, not walked on, but I was carried on the backs of so many people. My dad taught me a ton about work and life and ethics and construction. And he's been retired now, but I still call him today and go, Dad, how do you work on, like, you know, I don't know how to stucco, man. How does that happen? And then I met a realtor that transformed my thoughts about investing, a guy named Kevin Cook. And we've been friends now for 12 or 15 years. So those are probably three of the big key ones. And then I got a group of guys I meet with every Friday, and we just do life together and just share what's going on and how do we get better. from business to family to life. So
yeah.
Definitely a lot of people in my life.
Well, good, good. And then you sort of mentioned a little bit that your hobby is maybe being an entrepreneur, but do you have other hobbies that you and your family do?
So I love to read, and most of my reading is just pleasure stuff, although I tend to have 3 or 4 books open at a time. So some of them are about leadership and whatnot. I have a shop at my house, and I like to buy power tools, and sometimes I use them a lot. Sometimes I think I just buy them because I like them. And then I hike. It's like my daughter and I hiked Half Dome this summer together. So those are probably the 3 big ones, but I do enjoy working. I find working is life-giving.
Yeah. Half Dome. That's the one in Yosemite.
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
It's quite a deal because she was 5 months pregnant. So it was a bigger deal for her than it was for me. So.
and you probably had a hard time keeping up with her. So,
well, actually,
the other way around. And then is there anything that keeps you up at night?
That's a great question. One is I sleep like a rock. So technically, no, nothing keeps me up at night. I fall asleep. But things that concern me are, I watch what's going on with the economy, and I'm not worried about it. But as I look at my business and go to the house flipping side, you can't guess anymore where things are going with the Fed changing things or with the wars going on, and it makes it volatile. And so it's hard to buy something today and have a good estimate of what your costs are going to be, and what you might be able to sell it for. So it's there's a bit of risk involved in that business now. And I think the other part is just myself trying to be a good businessman. There's times I get busy, just like all the other businessmen. I sit at my desk, and every now and then I look at myself and I go, what would you tell your clients? Because I don't think you're paying attention to your own advice.
Yeah.
That keeps me up at night.
Yeah. Yeah. It's do as I say, not as I do sometimes, or vice versa. So
I get lost in it just like they do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find myself, I'm a good doer. I like to do things, I think my wife accuses me of being ADHD. So I like to do that. But like you say, you got to step back and say, hey, yeah, I need to be planning more and so on. Mm-hmm. Of course, I am semi-retired, but that just means I'm working 2,000 hours instead of 3. So, and then finally, what's your definition of success in farming?
I ask my clients this question all the time when I start with, I go, what does winning look like for you? And I think that for me, that winning looks like I'm enjoying what I'm doing. My kids are successful in life, not just financially. They have a great relationship with my wife, healthy relationships with my friends. And I think that holistic piece, just that's successful farming, because then you're producing good crops, you got a good business, but you haven't left all the other parts of life behind. It's all coming along. I think we can do lots of things well, and we should.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally agree. So, in speaking of that, I'm getting ready to go to Colorado Springs to the Great Wolf Lodge with 4 grandkids, my 4 sons, couple daughter-in-laws, my wife, and I'm not sure if I'm going to survive, but I will. So,
it sounds like a great time.
It will be. Yeah. It'll be hectic, but it'll be fun. So, again, Bruce, thanks a lot for taking time out of your day. It sounds like you have one of your entrepreneur things you have to take care of after this call, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Again, this is the Top Producer Podcast, and this is Paul Niefert, your host, signing off.